From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. At least 132 people, mostly children, were reportedly killed Tuesday in an attack by six alleged members of the Taliban at a Pakistan army school in Peshawar. According to local media reports, the army killed all six of the Taliban members who laid siege on the school. CCTV's Neela Iyani reports.
According to police, the attack began in the morning with the gunmen entering the school and shooting at random. Army commandos quickly arrived at the scene and exchanged fire with the gunmen. Outside the school, shooting was heard along with several loud bangs of unknown origin. In a statement, the Army said that they have entered the final phase of the search and rescue operation and most of the students and staff have been evacuated. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack, saying it is in retaliation for military assaults in North Waziristan. Let's go now to our correspondent, Daniel Khan. He's joining us from Islamabad. Daniel, great to have you with us tonight. Now, terrible events have been unfolding there. Tell us, what is the situation now, and is the standoff continuing?
Well, yes, at this point in time, the death toll now stands at 132 out of the majority is the school children of the Army Public School, according to the inter-service public relations of the Pakistan Army. And we know that ISPR says that six terrorists out of eight have been killed in this operation. And the government has called for an immediate conference of provincial and federal ministers tomorrow in the city of Peshawar. And security, we know, has been beefed up, not just in the province of Peshawar, but throughout the country, because since the Taliban have taken the responsibility of this attack, measures of beefing up security across the country have now started to be taken. Yes.
And you mentioned the government calling that conference and also beefing up security, as you said. What else has been the government's really main reaction to this tragedy?
Well, the Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif reached Peshawar. He left all his businesses apart and he went to Peshawar. And we know that Imran Khan, the chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, the ruling party of the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, he is also present in Peshawar. The Chief of Army Staff, General Rahil Sharif, also flew to Peshawar. And there is going to be a very important conference tomorrow between all these dignitaries. And they say that now it is time to become one and fight this menace of terrorism, because we know that several weeks ago a similar attack at the India-Pakistan border took place, in which there were over 70 casualties. So they are going to be joining heads and see as to how they are going to be tackling this terrorism, because we know that the army is already busy in Operation Zarb-e-Azab that is taking place in northwest Pakistan, in the North Waziristan region, as well as the Khyber One operation of this military to flush out all the local and foreign militants from the Pakistani soil, because we know that North Waziristan has been a safe haven for local and foreign terrorists who have been carrying out such brutal attacks inside Pakistani soil.
Meanwhile, another round of U.S. drone strikes in Afghanistan killed at least 18 people in the east and southeast of the country. Press TV's Fayez Khorshid reports from Kabul.
The U.S. drone strikes have escalated in recent weeks across this country, and these two strikes happened in Ghazni and the other in Nuristan in the east near the border with Pakistan. In Ghazni, we have been told that 10 Taliban insurgents have been killed. Their hideout was bombed last night by U.S. drone strike, and 10 people are dead and several others have been wounded. And also, 8 other Taliban militants have been killed in Nuristan province by another U.S. drone strike in that part of this country. But we have no word yet on these casualties from the Taliban leadership. We understand that these are the latest U.S. drone strikes here in Afghanistan, and now we understand that such U.S. drone strikes happen in areas where American forces are not stationed anymore. U.S. military in this country has closed most of their military bases in the provinces of this country. Now it's the U.S. drones that have replaced them, and such strikes are increasing.
Explosive allegations published this past Sunday in Proceso, one of Mexico's leading news weeklies, contained evidence pointing to direct participation by federal authorities in the presumed killings of 49 student teachers from the drug war-torn state of Guerrero. The report also revealed that Mexican federal, state, and municipal authorities were tracking the exact movements of the student teachers on the same night of the massacre in question this past September 26th, and that, according to the government's own documents, key testimony obtained by officials to sustain their version of events was actually induced via illegal interrogation techniques that amounted to torture, including electric shock to the genitals and extreme beatings. The report's revelations contradict not only the official statements of the administration of President Enrique Peña Nieto, but also most of what the mainstream media has been reporting from Mexico and the U.S. The Summit of Leaders of the Common Market of the South, or Mercosur, began Tuesday morning in Parana, Argentina, with a meeting of the foreign ministers of the regional bloc. The heads of state of the member countries are set to meet Wednesday. Argentina's foreign minister, Hector Timmerman, speaking after Tuesday's session, said the group is perhaps the most successful regional alliance, adding that, quote, those who criticize it are really criticizing the necessity to unite the peoples, closed quote. He said that Tuesday's early sessions focused on social and political integration between the members, as well as the strengthening of production and trade. Timmerman also pointed to one of the main topics of Tuesday's session, the project to establish a free trade agreement between Mercosur and the EU, adding that a formal proposal from Mercosur had already been completed. He said, quote, the European Union is still working on it, so Mercosur is waiting for a response, closed quote. Also on the agenda is the application of Bolivia to join the group. Venezuelans held a massive rally Monday in the nation's capital city of Caracas to protest sanctions recently announced by Washington against senior officials in the nation's socialist government. The sanctions include confiscation of senior officials' properties and freezing of bank accounts in the United States. Press TV's Jesus Silva reports from Caracas.
On Monday, Venezuelans held a massive rally in the nation's capital city of Caracas to repudiate the sanctions that were recently announced by the American government. The sanctions include confiscation of senior officials' properties and freeze of bank accounts in the United States. Addressing a large crowd, President Nicolas Maduro said that by no means his government and Venezuela as a sovereign nation would bear more U.S. hostilities.
The U.S. sanctions are so disrespectful that Venezuelans should collect signatures to repudiate their move and throw copies of American visas into garbage.
Meanwhile, opposition leaders have alleged countries' top officials of being involved in corruption. They claim that properties of such officials ought to be confiscated by American authorities.
For me, Venezuela is a nation that has the most corrupt government in the world, and that is due to a complex bureaucratic structure there.
However, Maduro dismissed such allegations and went on to announce legal actions against the United States.
I want the Venezuelan parliament to organize a committee of lawyers and campaigners to take the U.S. to international courts for violating human rights.
Venezuela's socialist leadership has so far denied evidence of any officials' properties in the United States and claimed that these sanctions are completely political in nature.
As leading figures from the opposition camp are trying to justify the U.S. sanctions against senior officials of Maduro's government, many here denounce Washington for imposing the sanctions on officials of a sovereign nation without any legal reasons. Jesus Silva, Press TV, Caracas.
I was pretty much minding my own business, just doing a simple recall of the mayor.
Simple?
That's all.
Simple recall.
Basic, you know, just going out, getting a few signatures. That's all.
That's all.
That's all I was doing, just trying to change the government around just a little bit.
That was the Reverend Edward Pinckney, the 66-year-old black activist from Benton Harbor, Michigan, who was sentenced Monday to 10 years for irregularities on a petition to recall the mayor of that Michigan city.
You know, I ran into this guy. He's a puppet. This guy, he told us. He warned us. He said, you know I'm a puppet. And he said, you know I'm going to use all my resources.
Yeah.
Whirlpool. I'm going to use the prosecutor office.
Wow.
I'm going to use the sheriff department.
Yeah.
I'm going to use the clerk's office. And we're going to stop you.
He was convicted of felony election fraud last month by an all-white jury in a trial in which no direct evidence of wrongdoing was presented. Monday, he was sentenced to up to 120 months in prison after being accused of changing the dates on several signatures on a petition to recall the Benton Harbor mayor. Pinckney is the founder of Bonco, the Black Autonomy Network community organization, and is one of the loudest, most outspoken activists in that part of Michigan. Benton Harbor fell under the control of emergency management imposed by the state in 2010. In recent years, governance of six low-income, majority African-American cities in Michigan have been forcefully suspended by state emergency management. Over the years, Reverend Pinckney has raised the ire of the powers that be by taking on the dominant power in the city of Benton Harbor, Whirlpool Corporation. The criminal charges against him stemmed from his attempt to recall Mayor James Hightower for foisting a multi-million dollar loan on the citizens of the city to achieve a mandated balanced budget while refusing to tax Whirlpool, a $19 billion Fortune 500 behemoth that pays absolutely no taxes to Benton Harbor, where it's headquartered. A majority of the elected city commissioners voted against the loan, but they were overruled by the emergency manager. The charges against Reverend Pinckney derailed the petition to recall Mayor Hightower, who many believe would likely have been ousted had the recall election taken place. Former Benton Harbor City Commissioner Trenton Bowens said of the recall petition, quote, "I've never seen this many citizens so frustrated. They feel the mayor is for big business and not about people. If the status quo does not like you, they'll do anything to get rid of you. It's a sad day," closed quote. Reverend Pinckney can be fairly described as a prominent black community leader in an embattled, impoverished city with a 90% black population where the powers that be wanted him discredited. The trial record shows a clear lack of evidence, and the punishment for what would usually be charged as misdemeanor offenses is clearly and unusually draconian. The specific charges were that some signatures on the petition to recall Benton Harbor's mayor were made one day prior to the 60-day window required by state law, and that the dates were later changed to make the signatures valid. However, the petition signers in question testified that they had signed the petition on the correct date, and no one testified that they had seen Reverend Pinckney change any dates. The prosecutor's forensic expert, Mark Goff, a forensic document examiner with the Michigan State Police, testified that the dates were written with two different inks, but that he could not determine who made the changes or when they were made. The crime itself of altering data on petitions is only a misdemeanor offense under Michigan law. Despite all of the foregoing, the prosecutor charged Reverend Pinckney with five counts of felony election fraud forgery. The 66-year-old activist was convicted on November 3rd. Longtime human rights activist Ralph Poynter was in Benton Harbor for the sentencing on Monday. We spoke with him by telephone Tuesday.
What happened yesterday at the sentencing in Bering County Courthouse, where Reverend Pinckney had been court-watching and trying to get equal justice for all under the law? In that same courthouse, they sentenced Reverend Pinckney from 30 months to 120 months. And the gravamen of the case was that someone, in the period of collecting petitions for a recall, changed the date on two signatures.
How many signatures were submitted?
700 signatures were submitted. And they more than fulfilled the requirement for a recall petition. Even though there was no proof that Reverend Pinckney had anything to do with the change of date, the judge sentenced him from 30 to 120 months because the jury had found him guilty of five counts of fraud. Remember these issues. There was no proof that Reverend Pinckney had anything to do with it. There was a go-between. There was a person collecting petitions who was sentenced to nothing, who was not tried for anything, who had custody of the petition. And there's no record of a chain of custody of the petition, yet they sentenced Reverend Pinckney from 30 to 120 months. Now, my interpretation of that, and this is Ralph Pointer speaking, my interpretation is Reverend Pinckney has successfully fought the corporation Whirlpool over the years as they take over a piece of land that they had deemed fit for black people called Benton Harbor, which is 95% black, and now they want it back, and now they're taking it over, and it's business as usual, taking over land that they want, and they are going to displace black people. They call it gentrification, and one of the weapons in gentrification is buying off any elected official. People elected a gentleman named Hightower, and he instantly became a tool of Whirlpool. More important than that is Reverend Pinckney, who has organized people to successfully fight the corporation, and he has used boycott. And if you notice, in all of the demonstrations, boycott is not a word to be used. Reverend Pinckney was using the word successfully, and therefore they went after Reverend Pinckney. This is a long struggle, and all of the facts are there for anyone wishing to do that, and we must bring pressure on this government in Michigan and the government in Washington, D.C. It keeps claiming that we must be calm and use the law to change things. So we are calm, and we are asking them, you know, we're demanding that they use the law and go after the corrupt officials. And I tell you, it starts at the bottom and goes right up to the governors. This is a big issue. We must not lose this, because if we lose this, we lose the vote.
More information about the case is available at the website bhbanco.org. That's bhbanco.org. Most of the information contained in last week's release of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee's highly redacted report was already part of the public record, with the exception of revelations on so-called forced rectal feeding of detainees, which, according to Dr. Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois at Champaign, is really rape as a form of torture. Dr. Boyle said that the real significance of the report is that a branch of the U.S. government made official findings of fact, which, in legal terms, amounts to an admission against interest. Dr. Boyle said that, based on the findings, he's preparing a demand for an immediate investigation into CIA torture by the International Criminal Court. He spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford.
I've already filed a complaint with the International Criminal Court against Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Gonzalez, Rice, and Tenet, and all their lawyer enablers like you, Bybee, Addington, Goldsmith, and the rest of them, for torture, war crimes, the enforced disappearance of human beings, and crimes against humanity. So right now what I'm doing is going through the Senate report, and I'll be making a supplementary submission to my pending complaint and demanding that the court move forward and open a criminal investigation. The significance of this report legally, now factually, from what I've seen so far, all the facts have emerged into the public record except this rectal feeding, which is really rape. International criminal law has a definition of rape, and that's rape, and it's torture, it's rape torture, and a crime against humanity as well. But the facts are pretty well known already for those of us who've been involved in this and following us. But the significance of this report is that we now have a branch of the United States government making official findings of fact. As a legal matter, this is what we lawyers would call an admission against interest by the United States government. It can be used against the United States government itself in legal proceedings. It can be used against these individuals. Likewise, in United States courts, since it's an official government document, it is not hearsay, and it is also self-authenticating. Up until this point in time, all we've had are press accounts. And I don't mean at all to diminish the significance of what the press has done here in getting the story out on the torture. Now, the mainstream news media are complicit, as we've seen the New York Times and the Washington Post have facilitated the CIA. But the alternative media and investigative reporters have done yeoman's service in trying to get as much of this story out. But the problem is, technically, legally, and I don't mean to diminish the significance of what they've done, press accounts are simply hearsay in court. So we need more, and now we have a lot more. Second, we will be using this to go after any of these individuals should they travel out of the United States. I've already scared Bush out of Switzerland for fear of prosecution. When he got word we were after him, he didn't go. I've gone after Bush three times now in Canada, but all three times those prosecutions, the proceedings were aborted by Prime Minister Harper, who's good friends with Bush. And I've also gone after Cheney once up there with, again, with Canadian lawyers. Center for Constitutional Rights is going after all of them in Spain right now. They had tried in Germany, but the German prosecutor copped out. So there are no statute of limitations for the commission of international crimes involved here. And these people can be pursued for the rest of their lives, just like, you know, we're still going after Nazi war criminals these days for what they did to the Jews, and rightly so. So that's the situation these individuals will be in. And then meanwhile, we'll continue our efforts to get them prosecuted here in the United States. So this is just the beginning, really. And we have a long, long way to go to hold these people accountable. But all the law, international criminal law, and United States domestic law is on our side, and the truth is on our side. But we really need the American people here to weigh in and demand that President Obama order the Department of Justice to appoint a special prosecutor to open a full-scale independent investigation leading to prosecution of everyone involved in this. That's what we need right now.
So in other words, the burden is now not on you or the Center for Constitutional Rights and others to prove these as allegations, because there have been admissions of guilt, or at the very least a branch of government that has made these charges on its own.
That's correct. And even Bush and Cheney have incriminated themselves. You see Cheney the last few days saying, look, we were briefed on these techniques. We knew what was going on. Bush has basically said the same thing. Indeed, if you read the Senate report, it all goes back to the Bush presidential order that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda should not be treated in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. If they had been treated in accordance with the Geneva Conventions, all this would not have happened. Obviously, there would have been isolated, small-scale abuses. That always happens in wartime, so okay. But not this massive policy of torture, sodomy, enforced disappearances of human beings, a crime against humanity, verging on genocide against Muslims and people of color. Right. Basically, you note all the victims here are Muslims, Arabs, Asians of color. So it verges on genocide. I'm not saying it is genocide, but it certainly is a crime against humanity. But it's really up to the American people. Look at, you know, all the African Americans now getting together all over the country with their supporters over Ferguson and Eric Garner and Cleveland. And it's going to take all the rest of us to demand that the government act, that the Obama administration act on this. You know, Obama was behind me at Harvard Law School. I've met him. He knows who I am. He knows what needs to be done here, and he's not doing it. And we need to build a fire under Obama. Yeah.
Most Americans don't know, and that's understandable, because American corporate media do not acknowledge that under the treaties to which the United States is a party, you can't just say, let bygones be bygones, look forward and not back, because the treaties require that there be punishment for these kinds of crimes of torture.
That's exactly correct, Glenn, but Obama knows better. And if you look at his statement this week and then at the beginning under Holder when he first came in, that's what he's saying. But, you know, Obama's a graduate of Harvard Law School. He knows better. And he's simply not telling the truth out there. It's that simple.
What we hear coming from the CIA officials and from Obama administration officials, actually, is that these people were simply following orders. That is, everybody below the very top. But that is, of course, the Nazi Nuremberg defense.
That's exactly right. That's the defense the Nazis made at Nuremberg. I was just following orders right up the line to Hitler, and Hitler's dead, so no one can be held accountable. That defense was rejected by the Nuremberg Tribunal, which, by the way, was our idea going back to President Franklin Roosevelt. Stalin and Churchill didn't want a trial, just wanted to take them out and shoot them. But Roosevelt's idea was, no, we had to have a trial, give them due process of law. So that defense was made, and it was rejected. So I regret to say we're hearing some of the highest level officials of the land make Nazi defenses, to put it into historical perspective. You're certainly right, Glenn.
And of course, much of the political dialogue revolves around whether torture actually resulted in the divulging of information that saved American lives or not. But legally speaking, based on international law, that's irrelevant whether it worked or not. It's a crime.
That's correct, Glenn. The Convention Against Torture rules out torture under all circumstances. There is a federal anti-torture statute with no defenses except the normal defenses under U.S. criminal law. And even more so, the Geneva Conventions rule it out absolutely and completely. Torture during wartime is governed by the Geneva Conventions. It is absolutely prohibited, even during wartime, which is how they drew up the Geneva Conventions to deal with a wartime situation. In fact, prior to 9/11/2001, the Pentagon itself drew up a manual for interrogation to be applied in actual wartime. We're not talking here about a bogus war against two-bit terrorists like Al-Qaeda. We're talking about a major conventional war. And in this field manual, and I've read it, I've testified to its contents in U.S. military court-martial proceedings, it completely rules out torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment as a matter of principle. And even the military interrogators signed off on that. The entire Pentagon signed off on it, first as a matter of principle, and then second as a matter of practicality. They know that this does not produce any useful intelligence information at all. It's simply a weapon of terror.
And last month in Geneva, the Obama administration, before a UN Committee Against Torture session, the Obama administration reiterated its current position that torture is inadmissible, improper, under all circumstances. Does that itself constitute a kind of admission of guilt that helps people like you in pursuing this legally?
Yes, it's another admission against interest against the United States government itself. Obviously, when President Obama came into office, he did sign this executive order against torture. So I'm not saying he himself is responsible for torture. But, you know, if he's not doing anything about it, and he knows he has to, that can make him an accessory after the fact to torture. And that is really what we're dealing with here, is does Obama want to go down into history as an accessory after the fact to torture and war crimes?
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.